Well, to finish what I was saying about Ethan is, I think it's fathers get your shotguns, mothers put your daughters in nunneries, because I think this guy is going to be one smooth operator. I just know he's going to charm the pants off a lot more young women than is legal. Talking about guns, the big gun initiative out here, or the proposal going to be put before the voters on guns, and they've been doing all sorts of surveys, and there's a national survey out on guns, and etc. And one of the figures they came up with is something like a third, I think it was 30% exactly in the survey, but a third of Americans have owned a handgun at one time or another. Not, and I think maybe somewhere, I think it's 20% presently own a handgun. So every fifth house, someone in, has a handgun. And that's probably even higher in places like Ellensburg. I just, as a matter of record, want to say we've never had we've never owned a gun. We've never had a pistol or a shotgun or anything like that in our home, and we don't see much sense in having one. I don't know if this is especially a goody-two-shoe view on my part. It's just something that I don't feel any need to have. Guns continued. I, as a non-gun owner, and I can't believe I would ever now own a gun ever, but in any case, I really feel safer knowing my neighbors have guns. I think because my neighbors have handguns, I think the people burglarizing homes and what have you, they know they have handguns, because their parents have handguns. So I think handguns do deter crime, even if I don't have one, because the burglar, he has to be very careful, because he doesn't know whether I'm one of the 20% that presently has a handgun in the house or not. And I know this is not an anti-gun view, the gun people say you're going to shoot yourself in the leg and all this, but I just feel safer knowing that my next door neighbor is armed to the teeth. Guns continued. I've fired about every kind of small weapon you can imagine. Just run through the list. 22 caliber pistols, 22 caliber, I was on a 22 caliber rifle team at one time, marksmanship, really like a club, I guess you'd say. 38s, 45 caliber handguns. I fired a Thompson submachine gun. That's the ones out of the old 30s movies with the drum on it, you know. I'm sure they're all collector's items now, or mostly in museums. Browning automatic rifles and 30 caliber and 50 caliber machine guns and 45 caliber handguns. And so I fired bazookas and the whole thing. And with handguns, as a matter of fact, that was a pretty good shot. We should add to the list 30 caliber carbines. I fired both of the major weapons used in World War I, the Enfield rifle and the Springfield rifle. Fired, of course, the Garand 30 caliber rifle, which was the weapon of World War II. And I fired all kinds of air pistols. So for somebody who doesn't own a gun, I have quite a record of shooting guns. Finally, I do know a young man. He was a student here at Central in our department. He went to graduate school somewhere, and he went to a party in a strange neighborhood and went out to smoke a cigarette and get a breath of air during the night. It was dark out, and you can fill in the story. He returned to the party, and they surmised that he went to the wrong house. Well, they know he went to the wrong house, and the lights were out, and he thought maybe that somebody was playing tricks or something, so he, you know, with the no lights on or whatever, and they knew he was walking around. Anyway, he went in the living room. He was shot to death. The owner thought he was a burglar, and he had a handgun to kill him right in the living room. He was perfectly innocent, really. He wasn't breaking in the guy's house or anything. change is inevitable, and one of the things we're dealing with in these tapes, or recording actually, is change. Change goes on at varying speeds, and if you look back at a society like ancient Egypt, you see that it took centuries maybe, but there it was changes very slowly, but really in a way inevitable. And change is often unnoticed, especially if it goes on at a slow pace. And one of the things that you achieve when you get older is you can maybe look back and realize how maybe radical some changes are. I noticed last night, I watched some of the World Series game last night, and baseball at one time was a game almost bordering on a silent movie. It was a slow-paced game. Didn't need a lot of talking, a lot of commentary. If you went to see it, or even if you heard it on the radio, they didn't need all kinds of, the listener or the viewer at the ball field didn't need all kinds of explanations. Well, last night's game had three announcers. Two were ex-professional ball players, both catchers, I think, by the way, and then a professional sports announcer. And I tell you, they talked nonstop, absolutely nonstop. I would bet money there was not a pause in the whole program of 10 seconds where there wasn't a human voice explaining something or talking about something. And I think it was really much closer to more like 5 seconds that they were just jabbering away all the time. So one of the changes you see in baseball is a game from once almost a silent movie to now this continuous, almost tobacco auctioneer's chant. And when the play wasn't going on, when there wasn't a batter up or whatever, then they had a review, and now they've figured out how to have a review of the pitches, bang, 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 if there's eight or doesn't matter, you know, it could be, you know, all these pitches to a particular player. They just play them real fast. They can computerize that and can see each pitch. This one high, this one low, this one outside. And then they have a computer program which diagrams, illustrates the way the pitch would look if you were catching the pitch. So you see whether it's coming in high to the batter's box or low or whatever it is. So they're never at a loss of words. And then, that being not enough, then they flash back to that very similar, and they have a whole repertoire, I guess, at their fingertips, that famous play in 1958 or whatever it is, and they could play those at a moment's notice, famous catches and hits, and, well, we're in a similar situation we were, they say, in the 1978 series in the third game, when, you know, and then they show that. And they just jabber, 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 jabber. So you're, what I'm saying is, though, the game has changed, at least the announcing of the game, has changed slowly over time to where it went from a silent movie to a tobacco auctioneer. Now, other things have changed, too. One of the things about yesterday's game was they called a relief pitcher in. He threw one pitch. The batter hit it. An infield fly, it was caught, the inning was over. He pitched one pitch. He was a pitcher that pitched one pitch in a whole game. Now that's changed radically from years ago when pitchers pitched whole games. They pitched a whole 9 innings through thick and thin. Now they may have 3, 4, 5 pitches in an inning. So the game itself has changed, and the way we talk about it has changed. Change, as I see, is ball players now, baseball players are obviously in the weight room every day, they're not playing baseball. They look like bodybuilders. They have tremendous, especially arms and good, big, thick hips. I just know they're pumping iron all the time. And there's some pretty good hitters and pretty good pitchers out there right now. The pitch speeds are up high now. 103 miles an hour they had the other night in the World Series. That's really, you can't see a 103 mile an hour pitch. I don't know if the old guys could pitch that fast. I'm not sure. So, but what I'm saying is change in baseball is subtle. You don't notice it much. And that's the way with life. Change is slow but inevitable and relentless. Change. I know a professor, or know of a professor, anyway, that in the mid-60s, say 1966, was driving a Volvo, and it happened he had a beard, and he drove into a town or a city, and I think the town was maybe Leavenworth, or in any case, not a big city, but you know, a local city. And as he drove along and came to a stoplight, some young people yelled over him, "Goddamn dirty commie!" Well, you know, now, that's 66, say 30 years ago, now, Volvos are middle-class expensive cars driven by the school teacher and their moms or whatever. Well, by them, in fact, by the guys that yelled that. And beards and mustaches and long hair and red hair and pink hair and purple hair and earrings and nose rings hardly raise a hackle anywhere, at least, and certainly no one would yell goddamn dirty commie at anybody driving anything looking any way. It's just inconceivable. So how things have changed in this aspect in just 30 years. Finally, as a, not a, maybe a kind of a ground idea, if not a ground rule, but I think it's important everybody understand that Margot and I are not in any kind of an old, the good old days mode. We don't believe that. We don't look back on our childhood with all this fondness. We think a lot of it was just bullshit. And we don't mind change. We welcome change. We're change agents in some ways. Some changes we don't like, obviously, and some we do, and some we're neutral on. But as a mindset, we're not, oh, for the good old days. We're not into that. That's not Marco and Quentin. When Ethan was born, now 16 years ago, I guess,
today,
it was, of course, touch and go. He wasn't as big as a mouse. And Margot said, in fact, the only reason he survived was everybody loved him so much that sort of that transferred. And there may be a little bit of truth in that, you know. We drove over there. I couldn't remember. I'm not sure Margot can either. But not right away. It was a day or so later. And we went over with Kathy and Jeff and the two of us. And I couldn't even remember how we got there, whether it was two cars, and Margot thinks two cars or one car, or where we stayed that night. All that's pretty vague. But anyway, one of us had this great idea. Hey, listen, this is a great idea. Let's buy something like a bottle of wine dated 1981, or a couple of bottles of wine dated 1981, and we'll save them. Well, we did that, you know. Although 1981 happened to be just a bad wine year, at least in France, where things really count. But we bought the best we could. And then, of course, we brought it back here, and, you know, it gets incredibly hot here. And that's not good for wine to be subjected to these too high temperatures and so forth. So, And we said, what are we going to do about this? And, you know, get up in the 90s and our wine, and some of it pretty pricey and all that. So then we had it, and then the unintended consequence of buying this wine, we had to go out and buy a wine refrigerator. So we have now a wine refrigerator, and I've had it for some years. Well, in any case, we went back, I guess yesterday, and we found some nice 1981 wines. And we're going to take a bottle of 81 and then I think a bottle of 82, French, nice French wine, and take it over to Spokane. And sit down with Ethan and have everybody have a family toast. And that's why we did it. We have some for when he's 21 and I don't know what. We did the same thing with Emma, though I'm not sure. Emma's was a great year for wine either. Margot said actually 19. Emma's birthday, I want to say 88, I'm not sure that's true, was a great year for wine. 1929, the year of my birth, was one of those stellar occasions where there was a very small crop and there were stars in the east and stuff like that, where they couldn't believe. They just couldn't believe it. The famous quote, I'm drinking stars, that was 1929. Kathy's going tomorrow morning to Hawaii, the first time she's visited there. I don't think Cindy has been there, although her two children were. The Fitzgeralds have a long, I don't know, would you say tenuous or whatever, connection with Hawaii. My father came from a family, I think of five, the best I can count out on my fingers and toes right now. He had a younger brother named Bud. He had a quite young brother. The youngest of the family was Jerry. And then he had a sister, I think her name was Regina. And then he had another brother. I'm not sure where he was at in this age group, but I think my father maybe was the oldest. But in any case, he was, and I can't recall his name right now, he was a pineapple soldier. He was right out of from here to eternity in Hawaii, and lived there for years in that $21 a month army they had there. I think he contacted tuberculosis, it seems to me, which was, by the way, a disease in the Fitzgerald clan, I think. My father's mother died of tuberculosis, and of course it was a big disease back then. But in any case, the pineapple soldier came back to the United States and was hospitalized for probably years, I suppose, in Denver. And then he moved down to Miami Beach and was a mailman. I met him in 1948. I don't remember much about him, just seemed like a hail fellow well met kind of guy, beer drinking, cigarette smoker kind of fellow. But the younger brother, I think he was the younger brother, had a whole bunch of kids. He moved to Miami too. I think he was some kind of a bookkeeper or something like that. So two of the brothers wound up in Miami Beach. They're both dead. My brother Thomas corresponded with at least one of the children of, I think, Bud, who was a cop in Miami Beach for many years. So where are we? I don't know. The younger brother, Jerry, is still alive in New York City, sick as a dog, I guess, kind of a religious fruitcake. In contact with Paula, making her life miserable, Margot says, and he's well into his 70s, I suppose, and he was, I think, a Benedictine brother up in upstate New York and quit that for reasons I don't know about. So this is a long, that whole family, and I don't know a lot about them. I suppose maybe we should sometime talk with my brother. I think he maybe knows more about them than I do. The younger brother, Bud, he had a whole crew of kids, and they moved to Florida. His wife was a kind of a loony toony wild Irish rose, died of a stroke. I don't know how I even know that. I remember visiting Bud's home. He lived in Brooklyn when we lived. I think he lived in Brooklyn when we lived in Brooklyn, and probably was part of the reasons my family moved to Brooklyn. But I remember one remarkable thing out of all this. I don't remember who it was or whatever, but one of the boys, he was just a little guy, he was a kid, like 4 years old or something, I don't remember exactly, but they had stacks and stacks of 78 records, and they were not in sleeves or anything, they were just stacks, scratchy, one on top of the other. But one of the things this you could do with this kid was you'd say, okay, that you could sing a little bit of a tune. Oh, say, can you see any bed bugs on me? He could go through the stack of records and pick it out, put it on a phonograph, wind it up, and play it. Oh, I don't know what you'd do with a skill like that. There's just a fragment of a memory in my head. I don't know where I heard it. I don't know if it's true. It's just this little fragment. And the fragment is Bud, the guy that was the bookkeeper that moved to Miami, the younger brother of my father, made this loony toony wild Irish rose, then a girl, I suppose, pregnant. And my father, this is a story that's in my head, I don't know if it's true, my father insisted that he marry her, and he did marry her, make an honorable woman, as they would say in those days. Then we heard another story, and I think I heard this from Paula, that Jerry knows that my father seriously considered putting Jerry in some kind of an orphan home because he was young and the parents had died, nobody was taking care of him, blah, blah, blah. And I guess he's still half-assed angry about that. But the funniest, one of the funny stories about that crew was another little snatch of a memory, this little fragment of a memory I had, was that Jerry was rewriting the Bible. Now, he was doing this, I guess, as a teenager, like 17 or something like that. I don't have a good handle on any of that. And I don't know how I even remember that. But when I talked to Jerry with my Tom, Uncle Tom, that we two of us went to New York and we took him out to supper and chatted with him and all this, business. I said to him, you know, I have this really strange story in my head, locked up in my memory, that you were actually rewriting the Bible once when you were a young guy. He said, oh yeah, that's true, I was. I said, why were you rewriting the Bible? That's not, never been clear to me why we do that. He said, oh, I want to get rid of all the Jews. A small correction. Margot thinks that Uncle Jerry was a Franciscan brother. I think I maybe said Benedictine. I'm not sure I could tell one from the other. In any case, we had recorded last night after my recording. We stopped and I recorded, and then the recording didn't take or whatever. And I thought of the expression snafu, S-N-A-F-U, which is an old World War II slang term, which is in a dictionary. I just looked it up as we ate lunch today. It means that something goes wrong and gets confused and things don't work or whatever. Situation normal, all fouled up, I guess is what it means. So we had a snafu. In any case, I think I started to say something like, I said, Jerry, I don't know why Jerry left the Brotherhood. I don't know much about that. I think Paula and Uncle Tom know more about Jerry. But Margot seems to think that he didn't just voluntarily, that he was sort of shown the door for some reason or other. I think he was quite irascible and probably bad at following orders and that kind of thing. I don't know. But in any case, he lives in New York City and he's sort of half-assed fallen to be a ward of Paula. Poor Paula, I told her she shouldn't have moved to Butte, Montana, or where's the other place, Marco, that I wanted her to leave? Boise, Idaho. New York City, because of its huge ethnic background, varied ethnic background, is a kind of a strange city. And there are all sorts of things that you, the average person, I suppose, doesn't know about or whatever that are, in fact, the standard in New York City. And I'll give you one example. When it got really cold several years ago, the homeless in New York City, we were talking to Paula about this, and Paula said, it's a constitutional, New York City constitution, or whatever they go by, that you have an absolute right to shelter in New York City. It's not like if there's shelter available, blah, blah, blah. It's you, everyone has the right to shelter. So when it got real cold, the city was legally, I guess, obligated to find homes for the, or some a bed for the homeless, not just as an act of charity, but because it's a constitutional legal requirement. There are all kinds of other rule laws. I think one thing is that New York was filled for a long time with socialists, communists, Jews, that have and liberals that have big government can solve a lot of problem viewpoint and that sort of thing. So one of the things that New York City has is rent control. Rent control came along in New York City, I guess, as a result of World War II, because they didn't want people to be gouged, and there was not very little housing being built, and probably none, and except for the military bases. So they instituted rent control. So we're talking about, I don't know what, 42 or something like that. Well, now we're in 97, and somebody tried to do away with rent control in New York City, and they went into a state of absolute rebellion, because what happened, and this happened, is a lesson to be learned here, you know, is that what was once just this little stopgap measure to try to fix a problem which would be cure itself in a year or so, or a couple of years when the war ended, now it's taken as absolutely a privilege, a right. And you're a daring politician to take away this rent control. Well, in any case, Jerry was involved in rent control in some way that, again, a lot of this, I must say, is fuzzy with me, but he lived right in the heart of New York City in a big hotel, and he had a rent control room in that hotel, and they couldn't get rid of him, the hotel owners, and it was illegal, I guess, for them to get rid of him. I mean, they couldn't say, you know, get out of here, we're going to break both of your legs or something. He just lived in this fancy hotel for years and years and years in this one little room because somehow it was all wrapped up with social concerns and rent control and things that maybe I don't fully understand. Does he live there now? I really don't know. I think he went to some kind of halfway house because he's such a sick puppy. I mixed up some Coleman's mustard yesterday for lunch or supper or whatever. Anyway, it got me thinking about that there are a few foods that have been in my life just since I can remember as a child. And so I actually went to the fridge and whatever and got them out to look at them. And they've been around just for an age. Coleman's English mustard, which is of course the standard for dry mustard, I guess it goes back to 1814. Leon Perrins, Worcestershire sauce, 1835. Durkee's mustard, 1857, and the last one is the Tabasco, 1868. So these are old, old things. And I think pretty much the four things I just named have been in our kitchen ever since we've been married. I asked Margot, in fact, about these foods, and I said Durkee's mustard, but it's really a kind of mustard mayonnaise dressing. It's Durkee's dressing. She said, except for Durkee's, she can remember all three in her home, although she thinks maybe her mother didn't use Comas mustard as mustard, but as an ingredient in recipes and the like. But yeah, I mean, these things have been around a long time, and other ones just come and go, don't they? There was such a thing as a mustard plaster. I believe I had one applied to me, or maybe more, but I sort of have this vague memory of this thing where they, in fact, made some kind of a paste, I suppose, out of Coleman's, since 1814, mustard, and put it on a, like a flannel towel or something, and put it on your chest till you blistered and looked like you were suffering from mustard gas poisoning. And it's supposed to have wonderful curative processes and all that. Who knows? And I'm going to ask Margot. Margot, do you remember mustard plasters or not?
No, I remember mustard plasters. I never had one, I don't think. But I've read about them in books. They didn't put them on a flannel thing, though. They put them right on your skin, and then they covered it with flannel.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. One of the things that was used in World War I was mustard gas. It was the Germans used it first, and they thought, of course, they could win the war with it, and you can't win a war with poison gas, I guess. And they used it. Who knows? It was horrible. We use phosgene gas and all that that blinded people and whatever. But I knew a man that was gassed in World War I. He was gassed with mustard gas. And I knew him like in early 1940s, I guess, like 41 or 2. He had never recovered from that. And he blamed all his health problems, and he had a truckload of them on being gassed in World War I. And probably he was right. Probably some of them were from that being gassed. Margot has a little story.